the recording has been started. If there are any objections, disconnect at this time. Thank you. You may begin.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone. On this evening's PEDNR call on the 24th of November, we have Michele Melon, Tatiana Kramtsova, Ron Wickersham, Cheryl Langdon Orr, Mike O'Connor, J. Scott Evans, Alan Greenberg, Jeff Eckhouse, James Bladell, Elaine Doolin, Mason Cole, Michael Palage, Dave Kisundio, apologies for the pronunciation, Marika Konings, Margie Milam from staff, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White. And if we have apologies from Matt Serlin and Sergei Gorbunov. If I could please also remind everyone, please to state their names. This is for transcript purposes. Thank you. Back to you, Alan.
Thank you very much, Gisela. I don't think we have any items on the agenda before we go right into the meat of it and start with completing the review of the constituency statements. Unless I'm mistaken, I don't have the agenda in front of me, I'm afraid, but that's from memory. If that is not wrong, I turn it over to Marika to finish up that while I try to have a bit of lunch.
Alan, are you in Adobe Connect?
I am in Adobe Connect.
Because Ron has raised his hand.
Okay, in that case, I need to get to the right window if I can find it.
Cheryl here, multitasking is a challenge without
okay,
one.
Okay, well, I had the... the window with people scroll down, so I didn't see it. Ron.
Yes, thank you. You'll remember last week I said that we didn't have a constituency statement from NCUC, and we had our regular monthly meeting this morning prior to this meeting, or this morning California time. And there is a, while it'll be later, there will be a statement forthcoming because they do want to have it, have the participation. So I'm getting additional help from the more experienced people to get that finished. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron. Any other comments before we go into the agenda? Or into the real work? In that case, Marika, I turn it over to you again.
Okay, this is Marika, and if I remember correctly, I think we left it last time at question five, whether to allow the transfer of a domain name during the redemption grace period. So basically pointed by the IPC that a transfer of a domain name should not be allowed apart from a transfer to the original registered name holder. I think this was taken in, and I guess Jay Scott can comment there, but more with the assumption that after expiration, the domain name was transferred actually to a different account or to a different party. And I guess this is more related to the recovery of a domain name instead of a transfer to another registrar. Jay Scott, I don't know if you want to comment.
If he doesn't, I do. I think there's a misunderstanding here. The transfer we're referring to in question five is the transfer from one registrar to another without changing the registrant. And I think this was referred to as meaning the transfer which could happen under a registration agreement, which is a different use of the word transfer.
Mm-hmm.
Am I misreading this, or is anybody?
Well, this is Marika. That's my point as well, and I think some similar comments were made during the public comment period.
Yes, indeed.
The question wasn't phrased properly, where we should have said whether to allow the transfer of a domain name to another registrar
during the
mention of this period.
Yeah, I don't think there was ever any intent to ask whether we are allowing the transfer to another during the redemption grace period. The redemption grace period, I believe, is only applicable to the original registrant, should one be able to find out who that was.
Ms. Merkin, this is a question. Isn't the RGP available to the registrant that's listed in the WHOIS details at that point?
Well,
can the RAE make a claim that they would like to recover their domain name?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I'll ask it of a registrar, or if there are any. Some registrars have been known to change the WHOIS during the various expiration processes. If that happens and the domain is deleted, does it get changed back to the RAE prior to deletion? So who is it that can exercise the RGP at that point? If the who is changed somewhere along the route after expiration date. James?
Yeah, Alan. Thanks. I was actually going to say something else, but I'll take a swing at this question. That's okay. I think, and I'm stating this with the understanding that I believe we responded to the registrar survey, that we do not change the WHOIS at the time of expiry. So I guess I'm speculating a little bit, and I apologize in advance to other registrars if I'm, you know, speaking out of school here. But I think that, it does complicate the ability for the RAE to recover the name in the redemption grace period in the RGP, which is one, in my opinion, is a sound argument of why we should not permit the domain registration to move to another registrar during this period, because only the original registrar would have that ability to trace back to the original RAE, and I think that and that kind of it segues into my other statement, which is just in general the idea of transfers during RGPs is that the transfer process, which I'm also working on, McKelly's working group on that, is very complicated. It's very fraught with confusion on the part of registrants, and it is also littered with security vulnerabilities that causes people to lose names at the hands of bad actors. And I think we're seeing the same thing to some extent happens in the post-expiry process as well. And I'm just concerned that if we're talking about here in question five about commingling those two periods so that you can have both the IRTP and the post-expiry process running concurrently, I just feel that really opens up the door to a lot of unintended consequences in terms of lost domains, security problems, and confusion on the part of individual registrants. So that was the statement I wanted to get out there. But as far as changing the WHOIS, I think that it would be difficult for anyone but the original registrar to restore it to the RAE.
My understanding was the registry had to know who it was based on the WHOIS data, and not necessarily the registrar.
That would not be possible in a thin registry, so I don't see how that would apply for at least in that case.
Okay, good point. Jeff?
I just wanted to say that you're right, that the registry would need to know the information for it to happen. And that would, and as you said, for as common net or both thin, that would probably knock out, let's whatever it is, 80-something percent, 90% of the domains that are in question that we're concerned about.
All right. It still doesn't answer the question of for registrars who change the WHOIS, do they change it back before deleting? But perhaps that's a one on that. That's a case that can only be answered for particular ones.
I'd like to try and answer that, but I'm not sure the question when you're saying so the name goes in, it's in expiry, right? The registrant does not do anything. The name gets deleted. What do you mean? I'm not sure what you mean by do they change it before they delete it.
Well, there are certainly some registration agreements that allow a registrar to change the WHOIS information past the expiration date.
That's correct. 100%.
Okay, and the question is, if they ultimately delete the name, do they change it back to Alan Greenberg prior to deletion so I am the registrant of record should I decide I want to exercise the RGP? All right. I don't think we need an answer now. It's more my curiosity than anything else at this point. We may want to look into it later. Michael?
Yes, thank you. Mike Pelage. So, James, I kind of agree with some of your statements about these concurrent sessions with changing who is and all these other things leading to potential security gaps. But what I'd like to do is perhaps let's take a step or two back. And the first step is, why is the who is being changed? Okay, because, you know, as I think was articulated in one of the, you know, comments by Christina Rosette on the public forum about how that may potentially interfere with the trademark owner's ability to enforce rights, I think we need to be looking first at the question of changing who is. Now, if, in fact, a registrar believes that changing who is somehow provides, you know, additional notice to a registrant that may be looking at his who is data, one way of doing that is not materially changing the underlying data. So instead of a domain name, Pelage.com, which is associated with Michael Pelage, one way of updating the data may be pending delete dash Michael Pelage. So instead of doing away with the original underlying data, perhaps just amending that who is data with an additional field saying pending expiration or whatever the status may be, we're not getting rid of that true underlying data, which then allows a potential inter-registrar transfer to happen during this period while not negatively impacting the rights of trademark owners to see who is associated with this domain. And I think that addresses your concern of, you know, closing some of these potential security gaps. I just, you know, I just put that out there as a consideration. Since you raised this topic earlier.
And if I could respond to that, I see there's a queue, but if I could respond briefly, Alan.
Go ahead,
John. Yeah, and I have one quick comment also, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, Mike, I think that the two are, I think there's, I was trying to draw a distinction or separation between changing of who is and the security issues. I think that the security issues are there whether who is has changed or not. But we can discuss that, I think, at length a little bit later. But as far as the who is change, you know, we don't change the who is, so I don't know what they, what other registrars do or, you know, or what their motivations for doing that is, and I wouldn't want to speculate, you know, why they do that. I'm just saying that it would be, if they did that, it would be difficult for someone like GoDaddy to go and then gain that domain during a transfer, during the during the redemption grace period, because we wouldn't have be able to trace it back to the RAE.
Well,
that was my only point there.
Okay, thank you.
I wasn't advocating for it or or anything like that, because we don't do it.
Yeah. Mike, just a comment on what Mike said. I think one of the indications of the difficult problem we're looking at is you gave a good argument why no one should ever change who is information. The counter argument that's being made is if a registrar is going to point my domain name at a pay-per-click page, or worse, we don't have any control what they're pointing it at, I don't want my name to be associated with it. So right now we're in a messy ground where there aren't any good answers to some of the questions. Jeff?
Yeah, so I'm not going to discuss what, you know, reasons for one or the other. I just want to say that I think we, this is, while interesting, has doesn't really have anything to do with transfers during the redemption period or anything else, and I'd say we just shelf this and move on because it actually doesn't have anything to do with the, with this actual topic.
I'll accept that. Mike? Mikey?
Ah, I don't respond to Mike.
Sorry.
I can't.
I corrected myself.
The only I tend to agree with Jeff, but I do have two sort of broad concepts that the business constituency introduced this constituency statement in the IRTTB working group, and that is that two things ought to happen at least. One is that if there is a name that play, one of the things that we want to do is slow the process down a bit to allow a dispute resolution process to unfold in an orderly way. And those processes tend to be slow. While at the same time, we want to speedily be able to restore the name back to appropriate state while that process is unfolding. So there just is this sort of overarching concept of speeding some things up and slowing some things down that we introduced in IRTPV and may also be appropriate here.
Thank you. Since I just spent the last hour talking about the URS, I understand the concept of you want to go fast and slow at the same time. Anybody else? Marika had her hand up.
Yeah, this is Marika. Just one point I wanted to make on this issue, and it's probably something to discuss in further detail when we get to the question as a group and not as part of the constituency statement, is that apparently some CCTLDs do allow a transfer of a domain name to another registrar during their version of the RGP. So it might be worth looking into why they allow that and, what kind of challenges that brings with it or, whether it's something that could be further explored in the context of this question. And also to comment on an issue that Cheryl raised in the chat box, whether this issue can get picked up by the transfers working group. One comment that was made in the staff report or in the issues report was that there's still a lot of issues that need to be dealt with within the IRTP, so that it would be a good idea for this group maybe to come to a recommendation whether or not to allow a transfer, and if this group would decide yes, it would be good to have the possibility of transferring a domain name, a possibility would be to defer the more technical discussion around that to one of the future IRTP working groups. That's something else to take into consideration.
Yeah, and I think that was indeed the intent when the council resolution is made. Michele.
Just a couple of things. I mean, part of the problem is between thick and thin registries. I mean, at the moment, the thin registry system seems to be causing more problems than it's actually solving. I mean, as some of you know, we haven't been an accredited registrar for very long, so we've been building out our own systems for handling transfers. And one of the problems we ran into was that transferring domains from between registrars when they're using a thick model is quite straightforward. You've got, as long as you've got access to certain things within EPP, the entire thing flows quite nicely. But when you come to start doing it with thin stuff, it can get quite messy. The other thing as well is just Marika's comment about some of the CCTLDs. The very important difference with a lot of the CCTLDs is that there's just basically an expired status, a quarantine status when the domain expires. There's no kind of 30 days, then something else, as far as they're concerned. And in all cases, they would hold all the data related to the registrant, which isn't going to be the case with the thin registries that are the bulk of the activity at the moment.
Thank you. If no one else, we'll go back to Marika.
This is Marika again. So the next comment comes from the business constituency, and they know that as there are several technical implications around the policy changes to the expiration process, they prefer to defer that comment until the working group has completed its analysis on this issue.
Okay.
And the next comment is from the registrar stakeholder group. And they note as well it's a complicated issue and wonder whether it might be better addressed under the IRGP PDP process, noting as well that it could be potential changes could result in unintended consequences, and we'll be informed to study those in further detail. And then the last comment from the registry stakeholder group, they prefer to keep both processes separate, and they know that a transfer can always be requested following the successful restoration of an expired domain name.
I see no hands up. Well, let's go on to the general and other comments.
So the first comment made by the business constituency notes that the preliminary work of the working group appears to indicate that registrar practices in connection with the transfer of domain names post-expiration may result in inaccurate WHOIS data that may materially impact other stakeholders in the DNS.
I think we can say that accurately. No comments other than my facetious one. Let's go on to the next one.
Next comment is from the registrar stakeholder group pointing out that the premise of this proposal is that something bad might happen to a registration, not that there is demonstrated harm occurring and a remedy must be provided immediately. The ICANN community cannot encourage competition and innovation and then seek to regulate it without clear evidence of harm.
And lastly, seeing no hands.
Two more comments from the registrar stakeholder group. Basically noted that as well, no ICANN policy or registrar practice can provide full insurance against unintentional loss of a registration or against the potential bad faith behavior of a registrar or reseller. And also pointing out that registrars are more than willing to contribute in good faith to preventing unintentional loss of a customer's name. And should the community believe that bad actors need to be addressed, a registrar will discuss ways to do so that do not needlessly disrupt operations of the good actors and further distract the community from more important issues.
On the first of the two, I would say I think all parties agree that we are not trying to create the perfect safety net, which doesn't allow anyone to ever suffer any harm from doing stupid things. On the last one, I think that's part of our discussion that we need to keep on holding. Any comments in general on constituency statements before we go on to the more perhaps vital input on the registrar survey? Michele?
Just curious, why is it that we never get any constituency statements from the ISPs?
One would have to ask the ISPs.
Well,
hypothesizing amongst the rest of us might not be seen as being politically correct or accurate.
I'm not too concerned about being politically correct, and anybody who thinks what I'm concerned about it, don't need to get a sanity check.
And this, Marika, one challenge might be that they actually don't have any members currently participating in this working group. Mm-hmm. And we have tried to encourage them, believe me, but I think they're challenged in getting sufficient participation in the different groups.
I think several of us are. Ron?
Yes. Question is a reseller synonymous with ISP in this context?
No, I don't think. I don't think they're synonymous.
Mm-hmm.
We have ISPs who are registrars, and we have ISPs who are resellers.
Okay.
And we have ISPs who are neither, and probably some who are both.
Okay.
In the absence of any more questions, let's flip to the registrar survey and see what you can tell us on that.
Yeah, this is Rick again. I've put together a couple of slides to take you through the preliminary findings. I'm just uploading now.
Pretty.
Cheryl, you are easily pleased.
Oh.
At this hour of the morning, Alan, as long as I've got coffee, I'm happy.
That wasn't Alan who said that, though.
Oh, who was it?
Mikey.
I think it was Mikey.
Oh. 7 a.m. here in the Antipodes.
Did you have any sleep since our last meeting?
Of course not. Sleep is overrated. You know that, Alan.
Okay, more to more serious stuff now. So the objective of the registrar survey was to review the current practices of registrars, and we agreed that the initial survey would cover the top 10 registrars, which represents approximately 69% of domains registered in a GTLD landscape. The information gathered, the initial information was gathered by Ike and staff, by myself, through internet research and looking at the different agreements and information provided on registrar websites. And I've been reaching out to the different registrars to help me gather that information that I wasn't able to find online, as well to verify the information I had found. So just to note that these are our preliminary findings. I have the complete findings and for the top four registrars from which all of them I have received feedback and input. I have completed my part of the research for the rest of the top 10, but I'm still waiting for feedback and confirmation on some of the questions from those registrars. So the results that are presented in this presentation cover those questions where information is either confirmed by the registrar or information that I found as a result of online research, but that has not necessarily been confirmed by the registrar, but it is information that I have found online in one of their agreements or documents. So the final results of the survey I can only present once I've received feedback from all registrars. Several have already indicated that they're looking at this, and they'll need some time to verify and check internally with the right person, right people. So I hope in the next week or 2 weeks that we'll have feedback from everyone, and I guess then the group can make an assessment whether additional research is required or not.
Marika, quick question. You said that you've collected some of the information, but it has not been confirmed by the registrars. Have you had any occurrences during the rest of this survey of things that you found online which the registrar said, no, that's not correct?
No, I don't think in that way, but sometimes they were able to provide some further details.
Okay.
So on questions like, do you send notices, I was able to find that, yes, they send notices, but the registrar was unable to say, well, we send notice on day 1, 15, and 20. So on some questions, I think, if I recall well, and, happy for anyone that's on the call that, already provided feedback to correct me if I'm wrong, I think most of the information was correct. It was
okay, thank
sometimes
you.
Sometimes a question of providing further details.
Got it. Thank you.
So on question one, what is the registrar's practice in case of registrant silence with regard to renewal? So I think almost all registrars renew the registration on behalf of the registered name holder. So I'm hearing myself in echo. As a courtesy, the RAE should be able to reclaim its name with most registrars. One registrar seems to practice that if auto-renewal is switched off, the registration moves directly into RGP. Gisela, could you check on the echo, please? And in that specific case, the registrant actually has to go through quite some efforts to get the auto-renewal switched off. So the default there is that a registration is renewed. And worth pointing out as well that most registrars do point out that recovery is not an obligation, but at the sole discretion of the registrar. And one registration agreement even goes so far that basically stating that the registrant has no rights on such a registration after expiration, and ownership now passes on to the registrar. Any questions on this question? Okay, moving on to question 1A, does the registrar allow auto-renew? The answer is yes for the majority of registrars. This question has also been interpreted as asking whether the registrars provide an auto-renewal option for the registrant. And in some cases, this is a default setting, and a registrant needs to take affirmative action to switch off the auto-renewal. In some cases, this is an option the registrant has when he registers his domain name. He can have that as an option or not. I found for one register that they actually do not provide the option for setting your account to auto-renewal. Seeing no hands.
Could I ask you, I'm sorry, Marika, this is my
question.
When you say a majority, are we talking 80, 90? I was just trying to get an idea here of when you say majority, is this like 51% majority, or are we dealing like consensus 80%? I was just wondering if you know, I'm not asking for a specific number, maybe just your gut call when you use that term.
Yeah, this is basically for almost all. This is just I'm putting majority because I haven't received, you know, real confirmation
okay.
for all of them. And for one, I couldn't find the information. So the auto renew at the registry level, I think it's common practice. I said with regard to the auto renewal that the registrar provides for registrants, it seems that most provide the option apart from one, and then there's a difference between having that as a default option set as auto-renewal or, you know, optional for the registrant to decide.
Excellent. And that most does a lot better than majority. So most helps it clarify it from my standpoint. So thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay.
Marika, when you're talking about auto-renew, I assume this is a mode by which you leave a credit card, a valid credit card, and say when it expires, renew it.
Correct.
Okay.
So question 1B, when, how are notices sent? Notices seem to generally be sent by email. Many registrars indicating that it's sent to different contacts they have on file, so not only the registrant, but also the admin contact and the billing contact, so reaching out to the different contact points they have. Some registrars provide a detailed calendar of when notices are sent, others don't. Some of this information is available on their site. In some cases, it's not. Interesting to note that two registrars actually note in their registration agreement that notices are provided as a convenience to the registrant and not as a binding commitment, which seems to contradict the EDDP. And question 1C, notices after expiration. Four registrars did confirm that notices are also sent following expiration, and some provide some detail as to when exactly that happens. One registrar indicated that they do not send notices following expiration, but they do provide information in the user account related to the fact that the domain name has expired. And there's a question as well, I'm still waiting for further information or confirmation from some of the other registrars. Then question 1D, are substantial changes made to WHIS data following expiration? Six registrars note, and this is well in the registration agreement, that WHIS records may undergo changes, such as replacing the RE contact information with that of the registrar. Most agreements noted as may, I would invite the registrar on the call to say that I presume that that's done as well the practice. There's no further information provided in which case it does happen or it doesn't happen, and that's maybe something to get some further information on. And when registrars, and I think James already gave away before who that registrar is, does not make substantial changes to the who is, apart from changing the name servers.
Who could that be?
Then question 1E, the cost of recovery prior to RGP. Four registrars indicated that the RAE may recover the domain name at least for a certain period for the normal renewal fee. Some cases, this period to renew the domain name for the normal renewal fee is as short as 3 days. I think another case was like 30 days or 20 days. In other cases, beyond, for example, the 3 days, an additional fee may apply, which in certain cases is specified that it's the same as the fee that is charged during RGP.
Marika, didn't you say that one of the registrars did not give any time at all in one of your earlier points?
Yes, it's the last bullet point. So
okay.
this this question is not applicable to the situation where the registration immediately moves into RGP and no other new grace period is offered. And again, I have to put the caveat here. This is what I understand from the information in the on the website and in the registration agreement. I've asked this registrar as well to confirm that that's the case. But from everything I can see is that there is the registrant, willfully switches off their auto renewal setting, or clearly indicates that they have no interest in renewing, then the domain name immediately moves into RGP.
Of course, an interesting sub case of that is what happens if they have indicated they want to auto renew, but the auto renew cannot take effect because of credit card problem or something like that.
Yeah, I think in that case I can check back on that, but I think in that case the registrar does go back to the RE and try to make effort. I think they already started that process quite early on.
Okay.
But you try to undertake several efforts to correct the data and make sure that it's a question that the to get the right information. So and I see Michaela's hands up, so maybe he has some more insight.
Michaela?
From the way our system works and from the experience I've had with most online automated systems, if the credit card on file is not valid or fails, which is not always the same thing, then most people's systems would send some kind of notification or make at least another attempt to charge the card. I mean, in our system, if you try to make a payment using your card, it fails for whatever reason, unless somebody's broken our system on me again, it should send them an email saying, your attempt to make a payment for order XYZ has failed. But I think I've seen similar type things happen with other registrars, but I'm sure some of them can comment. But I think that would be fairly standard practice. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, look, we're businesses. I would be much happier if all of my clients renewed all of the products and services they have from us, because otherwise I don't get any money. So, I can't imagine why anybody do it otherwise,
Okay, let's keep going.
Okay, so question 1F, when is the DNS change and where does it point? I think almost all registrars at least reserve the right to redirect IP addresses to a registrar-designated page, which may include notification or renewal info, but most of the time as well, in addition to PPC advertisements or other promotional information. In one case, the registrar agreement does note that the RE can actually opt out of display of registrar part pages if it indicates so before expiration of the domain name registration. And one registrar agreement even goes so far to point out that it may intercept any communication requests and monetize such requests at its sole discretion.
Do you read any communication requests as implying things other than the web?
I don't know. It did state it in such terms, and I thought it was quite bold.
Okay. In the absence of any other comments, let's go.
So question 1G, does the page say it has expired? 5 registrars indicated that the new page will display information that either the registration has expired or information on how to renew, or it might advertise the sale or auction of the domain name registration. One registrar said it does not contain any information on the fact that it has expired. And, of course, this question is not applicable for the registrar that actually does not operate in an auto-renew grace period.
Okay, when you say 5 will display information on that the registration has expired or advertise sale, I read those as two very different things. Are you saying the agreement says they may do one or the other, or some of the 5 do one and some of the 5 do another?
Yeah, I think it's more the latter. Agreements are very broad. They basically say, it may include advertisement or it may include, links to other sites, or, you know, I think only one was specific about the fact that it could display information on the sale or auction of the website, but you know, many of them basically have a clause saying, you know, the registrar reserves the right to redirect the page to another IP or direct, which, you know, without limitation might include a parking on the construction. Pages may include promotions and advertisements or links to registrar products, service offerings, third-party websites, third-party products and service offers, or internet websites, as well as advertise the sale or auction of such domain name. So a broad range of options there. And again, this is one of those clauses where, you know, I don't know, and again, I would invite the registrars maybe to contribute whether it's always the same for every domain name that expires. Does it depend on, you know, the point at which it is in the auto renew period, or is it the same for all? So.
Yeah. I think to the extent possible, when you do the final analysis, if you can identify how many of them say without any qualification that the page does say this domain has expired, you know, and this is what you do about it, regardless of what else it may say. You know, if you can do that, that would be useful. James?
Yeah, hi, Alan, this is James. And I just wanted to make a statement here that may or may not apply particularly to GoDaddy or to all registrars or to any, but to point out that some of the language that we may be gathering or acquiring through an analysis of registration agreements is going to use words like may do this, may do that, registrar discretion, et cetera. And I think that, you know, while they're informative, we would be wise not to inject too much of a conclusion or derive too much of a conclusion from that based on what we think the registrar's intentions are, when in fact it could be something just as simple as I want to be able to change my expiration page without updating my registration agreement, or I want to make a modification to the timing of the notifications without having to have everyone refresh or reaccept all of these agreements. So I think that there's a you know, there's a line here that we should be very, very careful not to see as a brick wall, but maybe as more of a chain link fence here, where we're using specifically choosing language that gives us the ability to improve products, improve notifications, make changes to the way a page looks or feels or designs or what information it links to, or et cetera, without having to redesign the entire registration agreement. So I just wanted to get that out there on the table as a way of setting some context for some of the responses here.
Yeah, I guess part of the question that comes along with that is one of our requirements is to look at this from the perception of a registrant, of what can the registrant reasonably be expected to know. So those two, I guess, have to be balanced against each other. McKinley?
I mean, I'm sort of echoing what James is saying. I mean, the thing is, if this is based purely on terms and conditions, agreements, and other legal documents, then no right-minded solicitor, lawyer, advocate, insert term here for your own country, is going to allow a company, be they GoDaddy, Black Knight, or whoever, to publish a document on their website without using modal verbs. I mean, by that I mean could, might, may, etc. I mean, apart from anything else, the thing is really, you know, it's a legal document. So if, for example, for reasons outside the registrar's control, some part of some aspect of something were to happen in a manner which was not foreseen, then, you know, the document has to cover, you know, use language which kind of gives you some level of protection. I mean, just to give you a really stupidly simple concept. Cheryl, what time of the day is it where you are?
7:30 a.m.
Thank you. 7:30 a.m. where Cheryl is. It's 8:20 p.m. where I am. I'm not. What time is it where you are, Alan?
I can give you the time, but I'm not sure why this is relevant. It's 3:20 here. Cheryl, okay. I think it's 7:20 there, not 7.
The simple thing is, I mean, this it may seem strange, but the point is that the international dateline and times of the day and everything else vary on which time zone you happen to be in. So if I am offering my services based on Irish Standard Time and you are buying them based on local time in Australia, mm-hmm. the date flips at a different moment in time for you.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah.
So
in fact, I've already gone a day ahead.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm just being quite realistic about it. There's an expectation and there's reality. I mean, we've had situations where people have said to us, "Oh, I had my domain on auto renew. Why didn't you do this, that, and the other, and God knows what else?" And it's simply because the card's expired. They ignore the email telling them that the card had expired. So the domain, whatever happened to it. So I mean, the thing is, it's that you have to bear in mind that when you're looking at some of these things, it doesn't mean that X, Y, and Z will always happen. It's a case of X, Y, Z could happen. So there's a lot more to it than that. I think there's a lot of nasty gray areas, but unfortunately, that is life.
Cheryl, would you like to make a comment at that point? from your consumer point of view.
I'm happy to. It comes back, though, to the registrant being well-equipped enough with understandable information that there's a high degree of predictability on what is going to happen. And things like I've put in an auto-renew option and then my card has expired and I've literally parked my brain somewhere else, that's one thing. Your systems or these systems tell me that there's been a failure of my card. I go, oh, yes, I need to change the date, providing there's enough time for me to do that. That's perfectly valid and reasonable set of expectations on both sides of the client and supplier equation. If a registrant then goes on to ignore those warnings, as you were outlining in your example, well, then there's little grounds for them to be saying others. It's for us to say that there's little we can do to help those sorts of people, nor should we. As you said earlier, Michaela, it's in your best interest to have a closed transaction and a continuation of the services. It's if you have a system where it doesn't say, by the way, your expiry date on your card is now out of date, or that the information does not get through to the registrant to say your expiry date is out of date, or that you forgot that that's the card you had on auto-renew information and your card's been stolen and new cards have been issued. That's the only point where a registrant, I think, has any grounds for not expecting an ability to redeem.
I mean, just coming back on that, Cheryl, I mean, one of the problems that we've seen is that in many cases, even when they admit that whatever has happened through to their own fault, they'll still try to argue with you about it.
This is human nature.
Yes, but the thing is that if you're selling a product where your margin is as tight and as low as it can be for domain registrations, you really don't have, you can't really afford to be getting into these protracted arguments with every single registrant. So in a lot of cases, you end up having to defend yourself.
Understood, and the best defence is to have all the necessary information, which it would appear from the survey so far, the majority do, so that there's a high degree of predictability and expectations are clearly set on both sides of the transactional equation up front. assuming, of course, that the registrant reads that, and that comes back to education.
I put myself in the queue because I've got some comments. I spent a good part of my life both signing and writing contracts, both as a service provider or product provider and the buyer. And one can write contracts in a variety of different ways to accomplish the same end. And, you know, if you look at any newspaper advertisement, you'll see a price, the price of eggs for your supermarket, and there'll be some time printed at the bottom saying, if we made a mistake, you know, and printed this wrong, then it doesn't apply. One can make statements that are definitive but have a best efforts clause and, you know, an exceptional circumstances clause that cover the cases where systems fail or people fail or things like that. So it really, one of them shows the intent of what you're planning to have, and the other simply is vague to cover yourself. And I think this can be done in a number of different ways. There's certainly not only one. James.
Yes, thanks, Alan. This is James, and I just really wanted to quickly echo some of what Kelly said, as well as respond a bit to an earlier statement that, you know, when we use language like this in a legal document, does it increase the opacity of the agreement to the average registrant? And I think the answer is, it probably does. It probably makes it a little harder for those without a legal background to understand. And but you know, let's not kid ourselves here. Registrants are, you know, my 12-year-old daughter as well as a Fortune 500 company. Registrants are individuals, churches, businesses, and some of them are also law firms as well. So because some of them require us to include this type of language, unfortunately now we all must abide by it, if that makes any degree of sense, because we have to write a universal terms of service for all levels of knowledge, familiarity, and background that that could be coming through the doors there. And I think that that's just part of opening this up to the broadest possible universe of registrants. They don't all come from the same place, same degree of familiarity. You know, I would say the folks who read the document or keep up to date. I would like to think it's a high number, but I think a lot of them, I suspect, just check the box and move on. So, you know, it's just part of the nature of the society and the times that we live in, and the fact that we're appealing to such a diverse and diverse base of registrants with just a variety of needs and backgrounds. So I just wanted to get that out there. Thanks.
Okay, seeing no hands, Marika?
Sorry, Alan, if I can just...
Oh,
I'm actually away from the computer, just not able to put my hand up, so I'll do it in real time. Just in response to that, Cheryl here, by the way, of course, this goes back to previous discussions we've had at several meetings, including the last one, the advantages of plain language contracts come to the fore. And Michaeli's also previously provided links to some of the toolkits and outlines that is available in UK, I believe, as well as Ireland. And certainly we've worked very hard in Australia in the telecommunications industry to ensure a plain language and single consumer contract for our mandatory codes.
Oh, you play dirty, Cheryl. God, you play dirty. I love it.
Kisses to you, dear.
She specializes in using your own words against you.
That's quite okay. That's quite okay. Cheryl knows me well enough. I can take it.
Okay.
Since Michael Pelage had to drop off the call, but I'm going to use... I'll say something that he might have if he was still on the call. James made a rather impassioned statement about why one has to use vague language in contracts, and Michael has sworn to what a good extent James's company does of, regardless of the words in the contract, making it crystal clear exactly what is likely to happen. So I guess one could look at this from many different ways.
Hmm. maybe a question once we have the full results that we might want to go back to those that responded to say, okay, well, we understand that this is what is in your agreement, but you know, can you maybe describe to us what happens and what is actually put up there?
Okay.
So moving on to the next question, 1K. I'm skipping a number of questions here as I don't have sufficient information yet to give an accurate representation of what's happening. So 1K asked the question, at what point is the domain name registration made available to others? In most cases, the registration agreement basically specifies that the registrar can, in theory, renew or transfer the registration to the registrar account immediately upon of expiration. But some specify that this is a practice, in practice, only happens at the end of the auto new grace period or a certain point of time in the auto new grace period. Some specify that the registration is put up for auction after a certain amount of time, and some dates that are provided there is after 25 days or 30 days after expiration. So again, this might be a question as well where the group might want to go back saying, well, the agreement provides for the option to transfer the domain name, but does it actually happen in practice as well, or on the basis of what assessment or what criteria is the domain name transferred or not?
Okay.
The question 1N, when does the name actually enter into RGP? In most cases, if not all, only if the registration has not been renewed by the RAE or transferred to a third party. There's one registrar that specified that they do allow for the RAE to notify the registrar before expiration, I think, that he or she does not want the registrar to proceed with a transfer to a third party, and in that case, the registration is immediately deleted and enters into RGP. And again, the case where there's actually no auto renewed grace period offered and the domain is explicitly cancelled, it will immediately enter RGP.
Okay, thank you.
So I added another question as I was looking at all these other agreements to have a comparison on the duration of the auto renewal grace period that's actually provided by the registrar to the registrant. Thought that might be a question of interest as well to the group. So it ranges basically from zero, which is the case in one registrar, for one registrar where a registration immediately moves into RGP after expiration, to 30, 35, 40, and 42 days. These are the different ranges I found.
And that is notwithstanding that the domain name may be transferred or auctioned earlier. That those seem to be a conflict in terms.
Yes, but I think most of those that actually start the auction before the end of the new auto renewal grace period do not actually transfer the domain to the person that has won the registration in the auction period. So,
okay.
If I understand correctly, and again, if the registrars on the call that have that practice, correct me if I'm wrong, the domain name is then actually transferred to that third party that has won it in the auction at the end of the auto renewal grace period. So if the RAE would still decide at that point in time that they want it back, they can still have it, even despite the fact that it's up for auction as
so
well.
So the implication of this slide is that with the exception of the one that has zero, the practice is that for at least 30 days, one can always get the name back for some price, not necessarily specified, but the contracts do not necessarily allow it. Do not guarantee it.
Correct.
Okay. So the practice is one thing. The agreement that governs it says something else. Okay.
Correct. And all the agreements have made clear that this is provided as a courtesy, and some explicitly say that even though we provide it now, it doesn't mean that we might provide it tomorrow or that it might change, and we have the right to change it without notice. So the agreements again leave room for interpretation.
Okay. Thank you.
Then question two, what if explicit instructions are given not to renew the registration? Most registrars seem to follow the same procedure as for no notice given. I think in only one instance it was specified that if the domain has been cancelled from the registrar system, it will not be renewed and go straight to RGP. And I think it's, again, that's the scenario in which there is no auto-renew grace period provided. So question 2A, how is the request for deletion prior to expiration dealt with? So for a registrant, request a registrar to delete the name immediately and not wait until the domain registration actually expires. Four registrars indicated that the registration is immediately deleted upon request, so immediately enters into RGP. One registrar indicated that they treat it as an expired registration, so it just follows the normal expired cycle. And I still need further details from the other registrars to confirm what happens there. So then the question three, and again, I'm skipping over some questions where I need further feedback from the registrars in order to provide a more detailed overview. Mm-hmm. So the question three is, where can information concerning expiration and deletion to be found? In most cases, if not all, information is contained in the registration agreement. Some registrars also provide additional information either in the form of FAQs or questions or concerns in the help center, or they have a separate deletion and renewal policies that I have documented and provide further details. It's not always obvious where to find the information. I think as I said as well in previous calls, I mean, many registrars provide a lot of additional services apart from domain name registration. So, it's not something that jumps out from the home page, and, you know, we sometimes really have to look as well. Some call it terms, agreements, service agreements. So there are a lot of different terms being used. Websites are different, so it sometimes takes some digging and some Googling to actually get to what you're looking for. I think, as we already discussed, like language and registration agreements, often maybe too legal to be clear for the average registrant, and often not very specific. The language like may not, it's in its sole discretion, there's no guarantee, it can change without notice. And I think that kind of information is not always helpful or doesn't provide you with a very clear picture of what may or may not happen.
Marika, if you can go back to that one. You say that you said that sometimes it required Googling and searching. Is that to find the clear information or to simply find the registration agreement?
For the first three registrars, I tried to find a registration agreement by just going, through the website and trying to find it there on a logical spot. But that would take me quite some time, and I actually discovered by just putting in the name of the registrar and registration agreement into Google that would get me to the right spot in one click.
Okay, so at least in some cases you found that it was not intuitively obvious where to find it.
No.
Okay.
But I said, this is partly as well because all the websites are differently structured and provide different products and services. So, it sometimes required a bit of digging of trying to find the right spot. But, to be honest, as if I would look from a customer perspective, that's not the first thing I would normally go and look for on a website like that. I want to be able to find it, but I don't think I would expect it to be the big banner on top of a website. I probably would find it disturbing because I don't want that information at that point. So.
Alan, this is James.
Yes, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, just real quickly, I want to point out that while the registration agreement may be difficult to find, going to the front of the site and looking for it, maybe more conspicuously featured, in fact, required reading when someone actually goes through the process of registering a name. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a balancing act. Does it take away a little bit from a registrant's ability to line up all their candidate registrars and, get their registration agreements side by side? I mean, possibly, but but it's that balance of making sure that it comes up when it's needed so that it is read at the most appropriate time. So I think that that's just something that we try to accomplish there.
Presumably before I have to give my credit card number.
Absolutely. But after you see the prices. So there you go.
You don't like the idea of not showing the prices or the agreement until after you get the credit card?
No, I think if Marika were to do a survey on that, she would find that those are, it may indeed have a very large banner associated with them.
Mikey.
This is sort of a comment about the whole presentation that Marika just made. A lot of us are on a lot of the same working groups, but in the registration abuse working group, I was on a sub-team along with Barry Cobb. I wish he was on this call today.
He's on Adobe.
Are you on?
I'm here. I joined late.
Oh, good deal. Well, I'm going to use your document in vain, so if I get off the rails, slap me around a little bit. Barry is really the guy that took the point on this thing, and he wrote a document, and I'm going to paste the link into the chat if it doesn't hose me up the way it did. Yeah, it worked. In which we were looking at the uniformity of the contracts as it might impact registration abuse. And several of the suggestions that the subteam is coming up with might apply here as well. One of the suggestions is that while we don't really want to cap the creativity or put registrars in a straitjacket, at the same time, we thought that it might be good to establish a baseline of what kinds of language ought to be in every agreement. And I'm feeling the same way about the material we just covered, that we don't necessarily want to put the registrars in a straitjacket about the way that domains are handled post-expiry, but we might want to establish a floor that says, here are the minimums. If you want to go beyond those, fine. Another thing that we mentioned in this document is sort of the notion of a consistent channel for handling problems. One of the troubles that registrants have is that because everything is different, it's hard to call your neighbor and say, Mikey, you've got domain names. I'm in trouble. I've let my domain name expire, and now I don't know what to do. And because my neighbor might not be a customer of the same registrar that I am, I can't really offer them very good advice because there isn't a consistent way to get out of a problem like that. And so I just throw this out as sort of parallel work that's going on in other working groups as an example of an approach to maybe dealing with this. Nothing more. And
thank you. Anybody else before we go ahead, if there's more to go ahead with?
This is Marika, and one comment to make, and I think it's something we spoke up about before as well, is that one of the options that the group might want to consider is, aside from registrars having this information available on their website, maybe there could be a requirement to provide the relevant link to ICANN to post that in a central place. So anyone looking for that information also has another alternative to look for that, without having to dig through a registrar agreement. I don't know if that's something that would be workable, but maybe something to consider.
Mickey, is that a new hand or an old hand? It's an old hand. All right, Marika, do we have more?
Yeah, no, just the last slide on the questions. And, you know, again, I would like to thank all the registrars that, you know, so far have contributed and provided information. And for those that haven't yet, I'm hoping that they'll be able to provide feedback shortly on those questions. And I know some are not participating in this group, so I do hope we get feedback from those as well. And I'm working through our registrar liaison team to make sure that we're reaching out to people that, you know, know ICANN, and hopefully we'll provide feedback. So, if there are any other questions.
I think if we need proof that ICANN's rules do not constrain in at least registrars to do everything in lockstep but give them opportunities for innovation and flexibility, this report shows that. Whether that's good or bad, we won't comment at the moment, but it certainly seems to be true. Any other comments? Any questions? Can I assume we'll meet again next week, same time, same place?
Mm-hmm.
Any dissension? No.
Nope.
I'm told there may be 4 STI meetings next week on the trademarks issues. So my schedule may end up being somewhat even more hectic than this week, but assuming no major conflicts, then we will continue. Otherwise, I may try to get someone else to chair in my place. If there are no
Cheryl
other comments,
Heath.
Cheryl, yeah?
Cheryl here. Perhaps while Michele is not on, we should put him forward as the potential chair if you're not available.
Well,
and agree to that before he gets back on the call.
He seems to be still on the Adobe chat room.
Yeah, but I'm saying it on the phone bridge.
The poor dear, he's got an IRTP meeting to chair that same morning. He might go easy.
All right. Well, if things go worse to worse, we may even have to cancel one. But let's play it by ear until then. And Ron has a question. Ron has a comment.
Yeah, just a question on stuff that came up on the mailing list. I can't remember if it was from you, Alan, or someone else, but about a broadening document or something that was promised and then was coming along. Is that does anyone know if that's still happening? Or
I think everything is still happening, but nothing's happened. As I said, I've been rather busy on the GNSO STI thing, so I haven't been as cruel a taskmaster as I should have, but I'm going to try to follow up on things this week. So I think things are still happening, but I'll report back next week. Anything else before we adjourn a few minutes early? I thank you all for your patience and for your contributions. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.